Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who and what have made Dallas the city it is today? When D Magazine published its first issue 35 years ago, the city had segregated schools and had never elected a non-white mayor. Larry Hagman was remembered as the hapless Major Nelson from I Dream of Jeannie, and the downtown arts district was still a distant dream. Frankly, we were best known to the world as the city that killed JFK. Our identity has undergone a pretty remarkable evolution since then, and D Magazine has documented many of the peaks and valleys. Zach Crane, Jason Hyde, and Tim Rogers all write for D and helped put together its January 2010 cover story, The 35 Biggest Moments in Modern Dallas History. Guys, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hi.
So you say off the top here that these big moments are placed in no particular order of significance. Was that something you considered at first and then thought, we'll be arguing about this till 2011?
Yeah, we did argue about that. And this is Tim, by the way. Hi. It was difficult enough coming up with 35 items. And then, you know, you can imagine when you start inviting people to participate in a project like this, we didn't just invite 35. We had to invite a few more than that to make sure that, you know, we'd have enough when they all came in. So that was difficult enough. To then try to order them would have been nearly impossible. And we did give prominence to some of the more important ones, but
and they are Colin Minches and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and they are, and bigger pieces of art and things like that. And they are numbered, but the only reason we numbered them was so that you could kind of follow along and know that when you're at number 20, how many more there are to follow after that. So yeah, we decided not to try and do that.
And it's also pretty interesting that you have, most of these are essays written by the people who were directly involved. That's got to be an editing challenge, working with some people who write all the time professionally and some people who don't.
Oh, no, they all came in perfect. Chris, I don't know what you're talking about.
All we did was cut them shorter. That's it. We're just cutting gold. It was a struggle. It was painful.
Jason actually dealt with most of the raw copy as it came in from the contributor, so he can speak better to that.
I was surprised how well most of it did come in. Obviously, these aren't professional writers, all of them, and we had to do a little bit of rearranging, a little cutting, like Zach said. But everything that you see in there is really the words of the people that whose byline is at the top of it. They really are telling their own stories, and some of these stories are being told for the first time, and it's really fun to see these little anecdotes.
The first story in the article is about the folding of the Dallas Times-Herald in 1991. How did things change when Dallas became a one-paper town?
Well, I think anybody that works at the Morning News who went through that transition, and, you know, Jim Schutz could talk about this, so could Robert Wolanski over at the Observer. Competition's always good for the consumer, anyway, maybe not for those who are competing. And Burl Osborne, who we got to write the essay, even talked about how that next morning when the Times-Herald racks were empty, he realized what then the Morning News had to accomplish. You know, one, who do they compare themselves against if you're trying to get a story? But two, then the responsibility that they have as the only paper in town. Now, that's, of course, the good way to look at it. The bad way to look at it is you just get lazy and, you know, you can fire reporters. And I guess it depends on whether you're talking to the victor or the loser, which way you would describe that.
Anybody have concerns that the Dallas could be a zero paper town at some point in the distant future?
I mean, it's theoretically possible, but I can't see how the city would work without that sort of voice. So I don't know. It's kind of on those guys.
Well, and I think the Dallas Morning News makes a lot of money, and that's important to keep in mind. For years and years, they were used to making a whole lot of money, and now they just make a lot. So they've had to cut staff and cut how much newsprint they put out, but they're still profitable. So the Morning News isn't going to go anywhere.
Jim Wright has a great essay here about the passage of the Wright Amendment, which created the loophole, essentially, that allowed Love Field to continue operating for commercial flights. First of all, who am I looking at? Whose thing is this?
Me.
Okay. Jason, what made that such a critical moment?
I think it was really critical because, for one, Southwest Airlines is an iconic company associated with Dallas, and I don't think that Southwest would exist, at least not in Dallas in the shape it did, if it weren't for the Wright Amendment. That we think of the Wright Amendment as something that's really restrictive, that, I can't just get on a plane in Love Field and go anywhere I want. But it was something that allowed Southwest to continue to grow there at Love Field. It really is something that sort of was freedom for Southwest in many ways. Sure, they would have liked no restrictions at all, but that wasn't going to happen. The FAA wasn't going to let that happen. And Jim Wright, you know, proposed this compromise. And so I think Southwest is what it is today because of the Wright Amendment in many ways.
And I love the way in his essay he took great pains. There are two things I love about it. One is that he took great pains to point out that he was not just a pro-Fort Worth, anti, you know, Love Field, anti-Southwest Airlines guy, that he really did feel like he was trying to do what was best for the region at the time. And the other thing I love is the story that he tells about when he tries to check in at a Southwest gate because he's going down to a funeral in Austin. And the I guess the agent there asked him to sign a petition to repeal the Wright Amendment.
And then realized who she was talking to.
Yeah, exactly. And they called Herb Kelleher up at that moment. So when Jason talks about, you know, these little anecdotes, these little gems that pop up in the story, the Wright Amendment can be kind of a dry thing on its face. But when you get the actual guy who was there, these little gems can float to the surface. Gems can float.
It was a great little detail, too, that, you know, Wright reminds us that Herb Kelleher was delighted when this was initially passed. He was not really upset by the restrictions. He thought, great, my airline is going to continue.
Of course, he's the one telling the story.
So, and, did you call?
Well, no, as editors, we were faced with this problem early on. Okay, so, you know, we can talk about Jerry Jones in a minute. There was a detail in Jerry Jones's telling of how he bought the Cowboys that didn't exactly jibe up with some previously published histories of that deal. And, you know, ultimately we decided that these people, I mean, we have a responsibility to hold, you know, make sure these people are telling the truth so far as we can. But you know what? Jerry Jones was the guy there. Jim Wright was the guy there. And if he says that Herb Kelleher was happy about it, then that's Jim Wright's version of history. And so we want to be real clear that, you know, that's what we're publishing.
It's kind of tough fact-checking memories sometimes.
I mean, I was going to say fact-checking with the people that you would ordinarily call to check your own facts,
right,
if you'd done the
exactly.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Jerry Jones and the acquisition of the Cowboys. Was that 91?
It was 89.
89, okay. Football is my least. I'm never well prepared for a football story. And this was something that people weren't quite sure what to think about when it first happened.
Oh, yeah. I mean, looking back on it now, I mean, it was crazy when it happened. I mean, they were getting rid of an icon in Tom Landry and then another icon in Tex Schramm. And, you know, Jerry Jones was pretty young. He was bringing in Jimmy Johnson. And it was just kind of really upsetting the apple cart, even though people were really upset at the time about the state of the team. But they wanted change, but they didn't want that sort of change. And it took a couple of seasons before everybody was comfortable with everything, especially the way it went down with, you know, there was the famous picture of Jimmy and Jerry yucking it up at Mia's, which was basically a shrine to Coach Landry. It was his favorite restaurant in town, and it just seemed
like a slap in the face,
mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'll tell you, of all the essays that came in, I mean, we felt we couldn't do the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history without having Jerry Jones talk about the Cowboys. And we were unsure up until the very last minute whether or not this essay was going to come in, because we're dealing with his people. And they kept saying, yes, 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 you'll have it, you'll have it, you'll have it. And I'm trying to remember, guys, was it the actual last day of
it was the last day.
It was the last day, yes.
And it came in, it's a great story, and he told it well, but we were pretty worried whether or not it was going to make it.
I mean, it was right in the middle of, you know, football season, so it's not like
he had a couple other things on his mind, sure.
He was a little busy.
Let's talk about 14-1. This was really a sea change moment in Dallas history. Talk for a minute first about how Dallas was run before the establishment of single-member districts and city council.
Jason? Well, I'll tell you, Domingo Garcia to write the essay. And, you know, as he puts it, basically white people were in charge, and they had a couple minorities that, as Domingo puts it again, who were safe. And what I remember most about Domingo's essay is when they all sat down to redraw the boundaries. So there was one councilman in Oak Cliff who wanted an all-white district there still. But, you know, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning in Domingo's office, and they're out, you know, one presumes with a Sharpie redrawing Dallas, you know, and changing history. And what that felt like to him to know that what they were doing, you know, with those pens and markers would change the city forever. And so now that, you know, you've got 14 people elected from, you know, different districts, it really made a huge, huge difference.
And I do think that that's what makes that particular essay so great. And what we were going for with all of them was, take me to that moment when the decision was actually made. Bring me into that room. And Domingo Garcia definitely does that.
Yeah, it clearly has changed the dynamic of the meetings themselves, and there's a lot more arguing that goes on. But in his words, it really does seem to make more sense because you have more voices and people are actually arguing about what they know as opposed to what they think should happen. And I think he writes about the idea that there were people on the council before that hadn't been to certain parts of the city that ostensibly they were representing.
And you can say what you will about 14-1 now and whether it's the best functional system for a city as large as Dallas is now. But you have to remember what the city was like before 14-1. There were neighbors, as Domingo writes, there were neighborhoods without, you know, any sanitation, without sidewalks, without, you know, gutters, and just real basic services.
Tim Rogers, Jason Hyde, and Zach Crane are with us from D Magazine. We're talking about the cover story for the January 2010 issue. It is called The 35 Biggest Moments in Modern Dallas History. You can join us anytime during this hour and contribute your own thoughts at 1-800-933-5372. So South Lake Town Square, Sundance Square in Fort Worth make the list, even though, of course, they are outside the boundaries of Dallas. But they were big moments anyway.
Well, South Lake, I think, is a huge deal because, you know, prior to that, I don't think a lot of people understood what the phrase, and Uptown kind of helped define this, too. They didn't really know what the phrase urban,
new urbanism
mm-hmm. was all about. And that development has been copied, you know, all over North Texas, certainly, and all over the country, too. We got Brian Stebbins, who was the developer, one of the developers of the area. And he talks about that 2 years after that they had, and it's been built in stages, and there's still more development to go on out there. But 2 years after they had done the first part of that development, they were showing someone around South Lake Town Square, and they told him that they thought it was one of the best renovations of a historic town square that they had ever seen. So I know I live inside 635, the loop, and it's easy to kind of look north and make fun of these ersatz environments. They're just kind of built, there was a prairie, and then boom, you got a town hall. But it really was groundbreaking at the time, what they did.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing to think about Sundance Square, starting with two city blocks, and now it's something like 20, which is remarkable.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Ed Bass did not want to take any credit for
really?
Being involved in it. Oh, no. He wanted to make sure that this was very clear that he's all about Fort Worth and that he did this for the city of Fort Worth. He himself lives in downtown Fort Worth, so he cares deeply about the city. And in order to get him to participate, we had to make it very clear that we weren't going to say, oh, Ed Bass saved and the Bass brothers saved Fort Worth. But in a way, we could say that.
and Uptown, of course, is sort of similar in the fact that it was built from the ground up and really took advantage of sort of a bad moment financially.
I think that's the most interesting thing about what Robert Shaw writes about Uptown, is that if it hadn't been for the real estate bubble bursting and the bank crash in the late 80s, Uptown would not be as we know it today. It would just be an extension of downtown. And I think everybody would agree, most of us would agree, that we're much better off with Uptown having developed the way it did. I think that's so important to know that because we are going through a difficult economic time right now, we should be thinking, well, what are the opportunities that are being created in our own difficult economic times? And reflect on the fact that just because things are bad now doesn't mean there aren't opportunities that are the city is going to be better off into the future. And Uptown is a great symbol of that.
There's a silver lining out there somewhere,
yes.
Potentially. We are talking about the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history with Jason Hyde, Zach Crane, and Tim Rogers, all from D Magazine. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes, and you can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Back in a couple minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history with Zach Crane, Jason Hyde, and Tim Rogers, all writers for D Magazine, which makes this its cover story for the January issue. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask a question, perhaps suggest your own biggest moment in modern history, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. There is a great little history in here of the debut of the TV show Dallas on CBS. And, of course, we've been trying to live that down forever, but it did at least make people stop thinking about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, we'd been living, I think, with that tag, 63, and you're exactly right. You can still go anywhere in the world today. And if you say you're from Dallas, that's invariably what you'll get. Gene Street, who has a restaurant out at Terminal D, will tell you that when people come off flights, he'll ask them, you know, what do you think of Dallas? And I forget the exact order of People's Recall, but Dallas is always number one. I think it might be, guys, help me remember, is it Mark Cuban that comes out of people's mouths?
Mark Cuban's one of them.
And then Dallas Blondes, the hair color, which we're probably the only city in America with a hair color associated with it. And then I think Jerry Jones and the Cowboys are right in there in the top four, too. So Dallas is like it or hate it, has branded this city, and I think will for probably forever. And the guy who created it was David Jacobs, and you're right, we got him to tell the story about how he did it. Now, he was not responsible after, like, what, the first three episodes?
After the pilot episode, it was basically taken away from him, and they brought in a showrunner because he didn't have experience doing it.
That was one of his first big hits, David Jacobs. So you tracked him down, right, in L.A.?
I did not personally, but yes. we tracked him down in L.A.
And he says that at first it was kind of a guilty pleasure for him that it was doing so well, and then he felt okay about it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what he was trying to, you know, he was very much a writer. He was one of the easier essays to edit because he came in as a writer and he knew how to form it into something that was going to work well. And that is how, what he says at the end is that it's not a guilty pleasure for him in any way. Because he is so proud of that show and of the history behind the show, which we never actually got to see on the show, but he talks a little bit about.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. An email from Bill says, I think the biggest omission is the unsuccessful campaign of Zach for mayor. That aside, do you see any present events that will turn out to be historical? I wonder if the City Hall corruption trial will result in historic changes in how things are done.
Well, that's I guess that remains to be seen. But I would say that if they do everything they say they're going to do in the next year and months and all that stuff, that would probably be another turning point.
Did you lobby for the Zach Crane for mayor inclusion?
Oh, we considered it. You know, we went around, and I remember it was a very late night discussion. And Zach himself, I mean, he's a very reserved fellow, but he just really wanted that to be in the issue, and it was Jason who said no.
Yeah. We still have to get that wall repaired.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rob in Flower Mound. Hey, Rob.
Yes, hi. I moved to Dallas about 12 years ago from the Northeast, and one of the things I noticed is the impact of the Dallas Stars on kind of the local, like, community. I was wondering if you guys included that in your story.
Yes, Norm Green writes about the move to Dallas. I hadn't realized that he originally was going to move the team to Los Angeles, but Disney offering to create an NHL team, which would eventually became the Mighty Ducks, kept the team from going to Los Angeles. And it was actually Roger Staubach who convinced Norm Green that Dallas was the place he should take his team.
Ron Kirk writes here about his election in 1995 as the first black mayor. I mean, given our history, this is a pretty remarkable thing even today to consider.
And what struck me about what Ron Kirk wrote is that he didn't realize how significant it was until right before the campaign. He tells a really emotional story. Mm-hmm. Just after a campaign rally a few weeks before the election, being pulled over to an elderly black woman who grabs hold of his face and pulls it down and starts touching him all over his face. And at first he pulled back, but then he realized she was blind and she wanted to feel his face. And she said she never thought she'd see the day when a black man was elected mayor of Dallas. And he said right after that he went over to his car and he got in his car alone and he just sat there and he shook, he said, because that was the first time he really realized the significance of his election.
And he credits Carol Reed here for coming up with the brilliant idea to send him campaigning heavily into North Dallas.
Yeah, because, you know, there were, I forget how many people in the race. They
seven.
Seven people. And he didn't think there was any way that he was going to become mayor without a runoff election. Their internal polling showed that they were only going to get up to about 48%. But then it turned into a landslide. And that's because he reached out to parts of Dallas that didn't know him before.
Do you think Ron Kirk's time as mayor changed the way we thought of our own dealings with race, whether we're black or white or brown or otherwise in this community? Or is that giving it too much credit?
I think we still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
There's no way it couldn't have. Just like the story he told about the old woman who just didn't believe in her lifetime that she would see that happen. To have kids grow up today and, you know that it's just like Disney with give me the name of the princess, the first black princess.
Is it Tiana?
Princess Tiana, the Princess and the Frog?
Yeah.
I think that sort of thing can't be overestimated. I mean, that really is significant for black kids to be able to look up and say, well, you know, that's normal. You can have a black princess. So why am I comparing Ron Kirk to Princess Tiana? But So it has to have an impact, but we still got a long way to go.
Because he could have called him the talking frog. That might have been worse.
And, of course, we have the Trinity River Project making an appearance here. By the way, there is a stunningly beautiful photograph. I don't know if you can say offhand who took it, but of
Scott
the Trinity
Miller.
River.
Scott Miller? Scott with
yeah,
one team, Miller.
Wonderful.
I can't remember how long that we dispatched poor Scott down to the Trinity a couple of years ago, but
he'll go out in any kind of weather.
Do you know Scott?
I do. We've had him on the show.
He's great. And you know, I joked when we were producing this issue that we should have put a cut line on this photo to say this is not Photoshop. So, you know, it's a picture. He got the light just right. You can see the river heading toward the city, and there's a gorgeous golden cloud floating over it. And it really does look like it's two pictures, but it's all just one picture. Scott's an amazing photographer.
But the piece on the Trinity River is actually written by Laura Miller, who writes about – it's certainly about the Trinity River Project, but it's really about her own evolution as a journalist turned politician turned mayor.
Well, and let me interject, because there were a couple of these topics where for one reason or another we felt that just one essay wasn't going to get the job done. So we had Steve Bartlett actually write about the beginning of the Dallas Plan back in 1992, which set the whole thing in motion. And then were you the one that finally got Laura Miller?
Again, not personally, but we were able to get her to participate, and that was so important to us because I think maybe her change reflects the feelings of maybe a lot of people about the Trinity Project that have felt both ways, both opposed to it and eventually seeing what it could do for the city. So I thought hearing her tale of evolution. Was so important in this issue.
As she points out, we talked about 14-1 earlier. She's the only Dallas mayor to have served as one of the 14 and then been the one. And that was her evolution. And if you want to criticize 14-1, this is a good criticism of it, because as just a council person, she was very much against the Trinity Project. And because of that, she was locked out of a lot of the discussions about what was going on. But then once she became mayor, and she was still not quite sure she was going to support this, she realized that the mayor really does have to think in much more holistic terms, and you can't worry about just your one little district. And so, you know, thank good. I guess that was about 2003 when she experienced that change of heart.
Do you all think 35 years from now that we will all have forgotten the acrimony over this and people will have just sort of accepted the project, hopefully completed by then, for what it is?
Maybe 35 years. I don't know. I mean, if we do this again in, you know, 5 or 10 years, there's certainly going to be probably two other viewpoints on turning points on the Trinity. So, I mean, it's something that's going to evolve just over and over again. So who knows?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You're welcome to add your own biggest moment in modern Dallas history or ask a question about one of the 35 listed in the magazine. Let's go next to Connie in Bedford. Hey, Connie.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, I can think of a couple of things that Dallas might be known for. I don't know if it's in any magazine, but one is the Highland Park Shopping Center, I believe was the first shopping center in the United States. And the next one I am positive of is the Kenneth Cooper Clinic with the aerobics. He came out with the aerobics, and I would think that would be something Dallas would be known for. And that's
great.
All I had.
Yeah, great contributions. Thank you.
Now, let's define our terms. So we decided to undertake this project in conjunction with our 35th anniversary. So we decided that the that modern Dallas history, of course, started with the foundation of D Magazine, and that's pretty clear, right? So it has to be after 1974. So Highland Park Village, that's what, 1920-something, Jason, 1920-something? Kenneth Cooper, though, that is an interesting idea because the guy invented aerobics. You could make the argument that that was one of the biggest moments in modern Dallas history if it happened after 74.
I think it was in the 60s.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go. That's we considered those two, Chris.
Yes.
And then after much consideration, we did some math and realized they preceded 1974.
Did you all go through back issues and sort of look at what the big stories were?
We had a 25th anniversary issue published 10 years ago, and we did look back over that issue to see what we had thought was important 10 years ago, and that certainly informed a lot of what we did, but no, we didn't pour through the archives.
And the other resource that we leaned on heavily was, what's his title now? Founder, president, poobah, Wick Allison. I mean, he was the guy who founded the magazine. He's still there, and while his short-term memory is non-existent, his long-term memory is actually pretty good. And we're all real young whippersnappers here that you're talking to. And, well, I guess I should be clear. We're all about 40, just shy of 40. Let's call it that.
35.
Yeah. Zach's 37. And so, you know, Wick remembers a lot of things when he was publishing the magazine that we, you know, we were still in diapers.
You go back and find your pass doesn't swipe when you get to the office.
We'll see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the 35 biggest moments in Dallas history. Number 15 on the list is this article by Dale Hansen of WFAA about breaking the Ponygate scandal at SMU in 1986. What got the school in trouble?
Well, they're paying their players. It pretty much comes out. They're getting
plain and simple.
They were getting free rent. They were getting paid. Dale doesn't tell this story, but I've talked to a player who was there at the time, and he said that, you know, they would watch film after a game, and the coaches would just hand out money. You know, if you got a sack, here you go. Here's, you know, they would just pay him right there in the room. And the problem with what they were doing was that they were already on probation. And so when Dale Hansen and his producer, is it Sparks?
John Sparks.
When Dale Hansen and his producer, John Sparks, broke this story that SMU was still up to these shenanigans even after they were put on probation, it's the only time that a major university has received a death penalty like that, and they killed the football team, which not only had long-lasting effects on the athletic program there, but also I think on the whole institution. I've talked to people there who will tell you that it makes recruiting students difficult. You know, I mean, when you don't have a great football team, it just academics suffer too. So it was a really big deal, and Dale is just a natural-born storyteller. I mean, he's used to working about a minute and a half a day, I think, now. But we got him down on his, we got him down on his ranch in Waxahachie, and once I got, you know, at first he's like, I don't want to, he didn't think he had anything to say. And then he started telling a story, because you can't stop him from telling stories. And I went, Dale, we want you to tell that story. And it's some great stuff. He tells a story about Eric Dickerson. Mm-hmm. Now, this happened after they broke the story, and he had gotten death threats, and someone sent him a carcass of a bird, you know, at the station and said, watch out, buddy. And
I know, it's like movie stuff when you start to hear this.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I mean, he'll tell you that it was the most exciting point in his professional career. You know, it happened all those years ago. But he said, you know, after, about a year later, somebody said to him, well, do you know why SMU was paying its players? And he said, well, yeah, because they wanted to win. And the person said, no, you missed the larger story. It was because of gambling. And this guy told a story about being on the sidelines, and I forget who SMU was playing. I think it was Rice.
Yeah.
And SMU was just slaughtering them. And say it was fourth quarter. I'm maybe remembering the exact time of the game wrong, but the coaches put Eric Dickerson back in the game. I'm like, well, why are you putting Dickerson back? And they said, well, you know, to help his Heisman Trophy chances, and you know, that's why we're putting him in. Well, no, it was because a booster had come down to the sidelines and said, you haven't covered the point spread yet. So that was the real story behind the story. And Dale's great. He does a great job of telling it.
It's a great story. And initially, apparently, he gets in trouble for reporting this.
Well, and, you know, he was also afraid because they didn't – so many of the legal team for Belo at the time were SMU graduates. And so he talks about how they had to go – I think they got a New York firm to help them through this whole process.
It was Washington.
Washington, because they just didn't think they could get sound advice from their own legal team.
And has SMU recovered in terms of reputation?
Reputation, maybe. I think this year they finally made their first bowl game in 25 years.
Yeah.
So – it took that long for them to get sort of even remotely back to those heights, and who knows if they'll last, but that's the first glimmer of hope they've had in two decades.
As long as my alma mater, TCU, is still doing better, I'm totally fine with that, and I wish them all the luck in the world. How did the creation of Craig Watkins' Conviction Integrity Unit change Dallas County?
Well, I think he talks about this a bit in the piece, that it was kind of an open secret for decades, the reputation that Dallas County had, not for malfeasance necessarily, but for just, you know, justice at all costs. And, you know, he didn't start the DNA exoneree process. I mean, that was the fact that they had kept all the DNA evidence, which is one of the few counties that has actually done that.
Sort of unique in Texas and even in the country.
Mm-hmm. But what he did is sort of codify it and expand it, and, you know, not just kind of wait for somebody to come along and say, hey, I feel let down by the justice system, but just to go in and actually review all the cases they had, not just DNA stuff, but other things, and just kind of make it a larger point than just, you know, one or two or three or whatever at a time, and just go back and look at how they've done stuff over the years. And I think that's sort of already on a national sense sort of changed that reputation that they had for so long.
And Craig Watkins gives a whole bunch of credit to his first assistant district attorney, Terry Moore. He credits Moore with coming up with the idea to, like Zach says, codify this. And initially, you know, Watkins says he was real scared of that idea because he was only on the job for about 6 months, first black district attorney. And he said, what, now I'm going to start setting people free from jail? This is what. And so he says that actually today he kind of regrets the fact that he was scared about that decision when he made it, when he was like, well, this is how I ran on, you know, to do change like this. So I thought that was interesting.
We're talking with Tim Rogers, Zach Crane, and Jason Hyde of D Magazine about the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history. If you think there's an omission on the list or you want to talk about one of the things that made the list, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about D Magazine's January 2010 cover story, The 35 Biggest Moments in Modern Dallas History, with Zach Crane. Oh, man. I can't even get it on the second try. Zach Crane, Jason Hyde, and Tim Rogers. We were just talking about typos, so it's ironic that I'm committing, like, verbal typos now.
So, like, Brangelina? Did you just join two of our names? That's great.
If you want to join the conversation and contribute your own ideas, give us a call at 800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You have in here the day that broadcast.com went public, certainly a heady moment in city history. Was it well known in Dallas before it hit the NASDAQ?
I don't think so.
I mean, that thing was really small. And then what's its claim to distinction? That it was the largest?
It was the largest single day rise
increase, because it started off at, they thought it was going to start at $18, I think was the target. And I think it closed at about $65. Now, we do have to admit, this is the one that we cheated on. The magazine has a sort of strained relationship with Mark Cuban over the years, and Zach has done a lot to patch that up. So he was the one, Zach did, that got Cuban to let us use actually something, a piece of something that he had written before about this experience.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, he allowed us to use a blog entry he had done on his blog, blogmaverick.com. And we were honestly pretty surprised, because he really, even for some innocuous stories, will not comment or other things. But we kind of broke down that wall with the Dirk Nowitzki story I did, which I was shocked that he would participate in that. And then, you know, we just kind of try to push forward with this. And he was just like, use whatever you want. And he actually wrote a really great story about that day. I mean, that was exactly what we were looking for. It was that moment. It was him with all those guys partying and nervous about everything, and you know,
as he saw how high the stock was going to go, that was interesting to me, because you think of Mark Cuban as a hey let's have beers, let's do it. But as this price started to go up, he said it made him really nervous because he realized these were people who were investing in his company and depending, you know, on him to, you know, for their future. And so, you know, he said how important it was the next day to go right to work, as hungover as he was, because he had to send that sign to the rest of the people he worked with, that it was important. Now they had a responsibility.
It really is funny to think about a guy who has as much money as Mark Cuban has now. This was beyond his wildest dreams. He had no idea that it was going to get that high.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Margie in Dallas. Hi, Margie.
Hi. What about for the Dallas history for Texas Instruments, because they had the little digital wristwatches and the calculators?
I think that may have been pre-74, which is when this all started.
Again, these are the 35 biggest moments, and we had to argue about that word biggest for so long, too, because we originally were going to call it greatest moments in modern Dallas history. Some of the moments aren't great. Like the banking collapse in the 80s. So that's why we came up with biggest. And again, they're all modern Dallas history, so 74 forward. And, man, when was Texas Instruments making, I mean, their very first calculator like that? I can't remember when that is, but let's go ahead and go pre-1974, huh?
Let's talk about the banking collapse for a minute.
Watch the calls that come in now. It was 1976. I had my first calculator.
Jody Grant writes that it didn't have to happen. Why was that? Or why did it?
Why did it happen? Mm-hmm. Well, it was a combination of factors, according to him. You have the price of a barrel of oil collapsing.
$9.75, which is just unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And then you have and it happened within a matter of months, and I think that's what made it so traumatic, if it had been sort of a gradual thing. But to have such dramatic change, and then he also pins it on loss of tax incentives for real estate, which caused some real estate values to collapse, and a lot of these banks had their money tied up in that, and at the same time you had the savings and loans that weren't being regulated very well at all, and so you just have this mix of elements that caused the banks to collapse.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Sam who writes, I would nominate the opening of the Sixth Floor Museum in 1989 as one of the most important events to occur that helped change the city. By establishing the museum, Dallas faced the assassination head-on and provided a thoughtful and sensitive tribute to the events of November 22nd, 1963.
I wouldn't argue with any of that. The hard thing would be, if the Sixth Floor Museum makes the list, what are you going to bump off? We said the arts district, we kind of tackled that piecemeal, but the DMA, and also the Meyerson, I mean, those were the first two down there. I agree with what he's saying, because it marked a change in how we thought about the assassination, but I would have a hard time bumping either one of those two that I just mentioned. So, but it's a good suggestion. And I confess that we didn't talk about that, the Sixth Floor Museum.
No, it never came up.
No.
It has to be hard when you are there. You don't want to leave anything out, but then you want to put in a few little quirky things. And I don't know that you'd call this quirky, but you have the opening of Ruth Street Cafe, which sort of made people think about Dallas as a really big, important restaurant town.
Well, that's why I wouldn't call it quirky.
I don't think it's quirky at all. I think it's one of the more significant moments.
You really want
even.
A fighter, don't you?
Oh, definitely.
Wow.
I mean, because Southwestern cuisine, it is very important to Dallas, and really put Dallas on the map from a culinary standpoint.
And don't get me wrong, Stephen Piles is near and dear to our heart here at KERA. He had a show on our TV station.
I thought you were going to say the Black Eyed Peas serving a chicken fried steak.
Oh, that is quirky.
Now, that I would call that quirky.
But at the same time, the fact that Dallas is chain restaurant heaven or the home of mega chain restaurants, and that part of that history all stems from a guy throwing together a chicken fried steak at a bar where a bunch of hippies hung out.
And we're talking about Gene Street, of course.
Gene Street. It's a great story, and I think it's significant, too.
And you know, Chris, corporations will test their menus here first. And part of the reason is, as Jason just said, because of that legacy. Also, it's because so many people move here from around the country that we sort of have a palate that can be depended on to, you know, if something is successful in Dallas, then chances are they'll eat it in Poughkeepsie.
It's not regionally specific.
Right.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Tracy in Garland. Hey, Tracy.
Hey.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, I was wondering how significant, I remember this because I was a teacher in Dallas at the time, when this first female superintendent of Dallas, who happened to be Hispanic, and I remember the Hispanic community was really proud, and then brought about a bunch of controversy when she was brought up on charges of, what was it, theft? Stolen furniture or something?
I think she had
something
ordered...
ridiculous?
I think that the accusation was that she had ordered furniture for her personal home.
Yeah, we're talking about Yvonne Gonzalez.
Right.
Yeah. Didn't make our list.
Didn't make our list. I don't think we ever really talked about it. We
I think we
had a separate list that might have made it the 35 biggest scandals.
Yeah.
That could have been on there.
Well, I mean, I think it's partially because for each institution, we tried to come up with one moment that really captured what was most important in the last 35 years. And for DISD, that is desegregation.
Yeah.
And nothing was going to supplant
that.
Which is on the list.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit. It's sort of hard to imagine, but we came to desegregation much later than most of the rest of the country.
And we were under judicial oversight for 30 years leading up to that. I mean, that's one of those moments that we sort of cheated, whether it was before 1974 or not, because the original lawsuit was filed in 70. But the fact that we had to continue to deal with that for the next 30 years, I think validated it being part of the 35 greatest moments of the last 35 years.
Yeah, I mean, on pretty much every level, we've always kind of lagged behind in terms of how we've handled race and things like that. So it's not surprising that it also got into the school districts as well.
Let's go next to Margaret in Dallas. Hey, Margaret. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Chris.
Go right ahead, please.
I think what is really significant and should be acknowledged that 27 years ago, Nancy Brinker founded the Susan G. Komen organization, and they've since then have raised over $1 billion and have changed the face of what women can expect to receive, or that they brought it public. You know, that was a time when only Betty Ford had come forward and even mentioned the word breast cancer.
Well, you'll be happy to know, Margaret, that is, in fact, on the list.
Great.
Are you just seating the calls now? Is Jeff Winnington in the other room telling people to call in?
I'm at home, and I'm listening to all the good old guys, you know, the Jerrys, the Dales, the Marks, and Gene Street. And I think, wait a minute, guys, wait a minute. We've got one really
well, and she tells a great story. I mean, great and tragic at the same time, but just sitting in her home upset about the loss of her sister, and just wanting to do something to make it happen, and the fact that it all started just from, you know, stealing her husband's Rolodex and calling people when he wasn't around, and has grown into this massive movement around the country is just absolutely, it had to be on the list.
That was I think that's probably my favorite essay that we have, because I didn't really know. I mean, I know obviously about the organization, but I didn't really know how it started, and the anecdote she shares at the beginning about the last time she saw her sister, and this all started with a promise to her.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's heartbreaking, and it kind of becomes even more significant the more you know about it. So I was really happy that that was able to be in there.
Let's go next on the phone to Harold in Dallas. Hey, Harold.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say something about the SMU football team.
Okay.
I teach at SMU. And I had four of the football team players in one of my classes this semester. And the whole game has energized them and everybody else. And I just want to tell you what wonderful guys they are.
That's great. Thank you so much for your call.
And okay. I know folks who've graduated from the school who are going back for football weekends for the first time, you know, since they've been out of school for 20 years, but are just now going back. And the atmosphere on the Boulevard is, I mean, it's it is rebuilding. So Harold's point's well taken.
Were there things that you talked for a minute, Zach, jokingly about potentially doing the 35 biggest scandals? Did you have to decide from the outset you were going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly in this, and not just the glory days?
No, I mean, I think we just start coming up with ideas, and then we was greatest at one point, and then I think we realized at a certain point that these weren't always great. I mean, in the terms that most people would think great is. So we did consider other ideas, but I mean, this was you saw the enormity of what we were doing, we kind of just dropped off a bunch of the other things we were going to do.
Kind of a brag a little bit, the enormity of what we were doing.
I mean, it's, you know, it's like what everyone averages like 500 words. It's a lot of real estate. So,
and then we had a fallback too, which, and Zach helmed this. There were just things that happened, and it just seems like you can't ignore them. And we left those for the pop culture section. And what we've been talking about, the biggest moments in modern Dallas history, those are things that really did change somehow how this city feels to us. And then, you know, other things are just silly, and we can't, you know, the Sex Pistols play at the Longhorn Ballroom. That's pretty cool, you know? So Zach, like I say, he helmed with 35 of just those pop culture moments too.
You want to give us a few of your favorites?
One of the ones I always like is trees. Nirvana playing Trees, mm-hmm. and the big fight and the brawl that sprung forth from that. the thing is funny to me about that is that Nirvana actually had to buy the soundboard that Kurt Cobain cracked, and that until recently was the soundboard they used in the Foo Fighters practice space. So it's like a little piece of us have always gone on with them and that band. And that's probably one of my favorites. And Sex Pistols playing Longhorn Ballroom, that's another one. And obviously Walker, Texas Ranger, that's probably my number three.
That was like a Fort Worth thing mostly, though, wasn't it?
Or Las Colinas.
It's all the same.
We're all brothers.
When it's exciting pop culture, we'll take it. Do you have a favorite?
I don't know. I loved Vanilla Ice item because it's true. When Ice Ice Baby came out, man, that was something special in 1990. You can laugh at it now, but
I was in college here, and
yeah. And we did. Joe Bob Briggs, aka John Bloom, wrote a piece for us about when in an episode of Monday Night Football in 1975, one of the producers. We talked earlier about how Dallas is associated with a hair color, and the reason he wrote this was because one of the producers had the TV camera zoom in on one of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders who happened to be blonde, and what a big deal that was for America's team and for the cheerleaders. So, you know, there's Barney. You can't forget a Jessica Simpson. I mean, there's just too much silliness that's gone on in the city that, you know, we couldn't ignore it.
Oh, actually, our favorite of those is Michael Scott getting attacked by a gecko on the NBC. That is number one.
You can see it on YouTube, by the way.
And I have the unedited version, by the way, if anybody wants it.
Very nice. Tim Rogers, Zach Crane, and Jason Hyde all write for D Magazine. You can check out the 35 biggest moments in modern Dallas history in the January 2010 cover story. Guys, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.